really quickly, we'll move off the physical allergy. You guys understand what it means to have a physical allergy to alcohol, the abnormal reaction, the inability to control what, you know, how much you drink once you start. Okay? Very simply. This is quickly the most succinct way of explaining it. So I was sitting in gym class, and they used to talk about how alcohol was a central nervous system depressant. I used to get really fucking confused because I never went down. I always went up when I drank until I passed out. And I could never understand why they would say it was a central nervous system depressant, because it didn't depress nothing in me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the abnormal reaction to alcohol. That's the allergy. Now, I didn't realize that in seventh grade when I was drinking like an alcoholic. I always just thought, wow, that's weird.
I smoke pot and clean my house.
Yeah.
You know, I get wired off of it, you know. Booze is like a primer on the engine. You know, you press the button and you can start your chainsaw, you know.
Yep.
That's what it is to me, you know. Normal people don't feel that way. Her sister's a great example.
No, she has nightcaps.
She has half a glass of wine and feels sleepy. I was like, huh?
That's the weirdest thing. She'll have like a bottle of wine sitting on her counter for like a month. And it's like 3/4 of the way full. What's wrong with you? I only drink good wine.
We're on page 17, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah, I was going to actually...
You wanted to talk about...
The common peril, common solution. Yes.
Well, it starts off at the top of that paragraph. It says,
page
we are
17.
People who would normally not mix. You know, how many times you walk in a room, you see, you know, the soccer mom, you know, the degenerate dirtbag with the tattoos and the guy in the suit and tie. You know, it's like, we are not people that would normally mix, you know. But the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element of the powerful cement which binds us.
And that's why, like, when you walk into AA and they say, identify, don't compare. We need to identify. I really identified with your share. I really identified. Well, that's nice. But really, that's only one part of what we're here to do. It's common peril, common solution. So a lot of people have the common peril, but they miss that whole common solution. They, you know, I work the steps my way, cafeteria. Or, like, even if we do actually work the steps, I mean, a lot of people just don't. But, like, people who like to think that they do actually work some kind of a program, say, I work my program, and, you know, take what you want and leave the rest sort of stuff.
It's that off-the-wall program.
Yeah, off-the-wall, you know.
You work your program off the wall.
You checklist
the
steps.
Program.
Yeah, I checklist. I'm powerless. Okay, yeah, maybe there's a God. He's nice. I like him. I did some fucked up shit. Okay, there's a moral inventory. No. So the idea is that we have common power, common solution. So it's not just about identification. Identification is just one aspect of the first step. That's really all it is. I mean, really, when you think about it, that's all it is. We're talking about one step that has common peril. The rest of it is common solution. You know, so that's the cement that binds us. And so when I'm carrying a message, I want to make sure, yes, I'm going to get you with the common peril. I'm going to talk about the three aspects of alcoholism, but I am going to slam it back with common solution. I'm going to talk about, okay, this is what I got, these three things, and this is how I treat it, dude, with this, with the other 11 steps, man. So we're going to talk about what it means, you know, and that's the message I want to carry, something that has depth and weight. So we want to put out that fishing hook and be able to hook people on that common peril, but we need to be able to offer a solution, because the whole point is saying, okay, we're all fucked. All right, you know, good, let's go home. No, we're all fucked. We got a disease that's deadly and yada, 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 but here's a solution to that. This is what we do in order to recover. And this is what recovery looks like, a pile of Adderall on the table and I don't take it. You know? That's what being recovered with an ED looks like. Placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. You know? And we want to be able to carry that message with those three things. So when we think about it, we're talking about the identification, the three parts of the alcoholism. Common solution, what we do to treat it, and what being recovered looks like. You know, if we can carry that, those three things when we're carrying a message, when we're out there pressing the flesh recruiting for our cause, we're going to be really successful in how and being able to get people to be willing to take a look at this book in a different way, to get them to put aside their what they think they know about AA. You know, so we want common peril and common solution. You know, so here's the thing, is that we all agree on the common solution. What is the common solution?
God.
Well, no, but how do we get to that ultimate common solution? How do we do that? Thank you.
The vehicle.
Exactly.
Why I've always been a firm believer that the steps aren't my solution. They're not. You know, the steps are a vehicle to my solution. You know, and yeah, without that vehicle, I'm never going to get to the solution. I need that vehicle. But I'm sorry. I'm the one who got tied up in rigidness and ritual and started to worship the 12 steps. You know, and that's really, you know, I want to impress that on people, because you worship the 12 steps, you go just as fucking crazy as if you're worshiping the booze. You know, it's no human power could relieve my alcoholism. No human power. And that includes the 12 steps. And just to throw something else at you, it might mess with your brain a little bit. Working with others is a human power. Okay? Why do I work with others? Do I work with others to stay sober? Or do I work with others because I love God and I'm grateful for what God has given me?
Yeah. Because there's a lot of groups out by us who are essentially what we call two-steppers. I mean, they go through the work like in a very rudimentary way. They have like checklist four steps and like kind of like, you know, the old fashioned Joe and Charlie, you know, back in the day, and the, like those four steps that like if my sponsee came to me with that four step, I'd shove it up her ass. Like, dude, no, you're rewriting this. I'm serious. Like, there's no insight here. You know, no offense to Joe and Charlie, because they did save my behind back in the day, but I've come to have like a more well-rounded approach to the four step and the fifth step. But, you know, so we have these people who they do these very rudimentary four steps. Their A-step list is like pretty short, and they go out and they carry the message, and they're full-fledged, full-fisted 12-steppers, and they're carrying a message and beating people with the book, and they're awesome. But they're freaking nuts, and they're total dicks, and they don't know why nobody likes them. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's because they're using the 12-step as a way to manage their character defects, and it's like, well, you know, there's a better way of dealing with that.
I don't feel good today. I better grab a newcomer.
Yeah.
You know, something's wrong. I better grab a newcomer. You know, and yeah, that does help. But it's the same thing as going to a meeting and dumping my problems.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Band-Aid. Right. It's a Band-Aid. You know, I'm all about, I was telling one of my sponsees this yesterday or the day before, you know, what you do is when the fear hits you, you don't go and grab a newcomer. You ask God to remove the fear. You look at why you're having this fear. What's going on? What perhaps is a better way? And then go grab a newcomer.
Yeah.
You
know? Skip that stuff in between.
Don't skip that stuff in between.
Yeah. Because that's the meat. Because that's where the insight comes. That's where the surrender comes.
That's the
And the grabbing the newcomer, then grabbing the newcomer is simply just turning away from myself. But I have to know what's going on, and I have to know what I'm surrendering. If I just surrender it to God, and I don't realize, if I'm not looking at what I'm surrendering, if I don't know what it is that I'm surrendering, then I'm not taking personal responsibility for my recovery. I'm simply just saying, oh, well. That's not really what we want to be able to do here. We want to be able to have insight. I want to know why I'm being a stupid head. I need to be able to know that. You know, I need to know, I want to know what it is that I'm surrendering. And then I'm turning my thoughts to someone else. Because you know what? By knowing what it is that I'm surrendering, when I see somebody that I'm turning my thoughts to someone else and being of service to, doing the very same things, I can ask them those questions that bring them to their truth. If I lack the insight, I have no insight to carry. So we don't want to navel gaze to the point where we're paralyzed, but we do want to know, like, why do I think this way? What is motivating this thought process? What's motivating this behavior? And then we turn that to God. Then we turn our thoughts to someone else. And it makes us more effective sponsors. Because I don't know how many times I've had people come to me and like, well, I'm exhibiting this behavior. I'm like, okay, why do you think you do that? I don't know. Well, let's break this down. So, what were you thinking when you did that?
I don't know.
Well, what were you thinking before you thought, I don't know, you know, and it's pulling teeth, and it's like, well, I don't know why I do that. Well, I don't know. It's like talking to a 5-year-old. Like my 6-year-old is more insight. And it's because part of it is that, you know, there's that real not want to look. Like if I look at that black hole, I might see something scary. Guess what? There's nothing scary. You're not Charles Manson, man. You're just a human being having a human experience. There's nothing that is deep, dark, or evil in you. Nothing. But there's that fear, so I'm not going to look. So I'm going to exhibit this behavior, and I'm going to go to my sponsor and say, help me not do this. But I don't know why I do it, because I'm too afraid to look within myself to find out why I do the silly things I do. So fix it. No. I mean, it requires, and it says this, you know, this process requires me to be searching and fearless. I need to be thorough. So, yeah, we don't skip right to turn my thoughts to someone else. We do those little tiny things in between. That's the internal work. There's the internal and external work. And we need to do both. Because we're talking about holistic. Holistic, that is the word for the weekend. A holistic approach to the steps. Not just, you know, what I'm doing on the outside, but also what I'm doing within.
We feel the elimination, page 19. We feel the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs.
So what do they look like, man? Who's hating on your ass this weekend? Who's not happy with you?
My thing is AA doesn't happen in a church basement. AA happens at the supermarket, at the gas station, you know, on the highway, in the parking lot, you know, at the school, you know.
Yeah.
AA happens at my job, you know. I don't run into my job. I'm an alcoholic. No, it's who I am. It's what I bring to my life, you know. I go to AA meetings. Yeah, I go there to find a newcomer. I go there to be of service. I don't go there to get AA, but AA happens everywhere I go. It has to, you know. It happens in my living room.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I work with psychotic individuals, like literally. I work with a chronically mentally ill, and almost everybody that I work with has some form of psychosis, which means that I often become an intricate part of their delusional world. I mean, that's a wonderful thing about psychosis. It sort of evolves. So, like, at any given point of the day, I might have somebody come up to me and say, Carrie, 10 years ago, you did this awfully terrible thing to me. Okay. And I really want to discuss this with you.
Okay. Been working here 6 months?
Yeah. I've only known you for 6 months, but 10 years ago I stole whatever. Or, I mean, one of my clients actually thinks that we're having an illicit affair, which I was not aware of. It's a little freaky. Or one of my other clients thinks that I visit his room at night, my spirit. I astral project into his room. Now, if I didn't apply these principles in my daily life, if I really didn't live this, I mean, this is what we're talking about. And can you imagine somebody coming up to you and accusing you of going into the room at night? You know, and doing things like moving their shoes. I don't know what. I don't know what he thinks I do in there at night, but whatever. I didn't ask. I didn't go that far. I didn't go that far. I was like, I'm steering real clear of that. But my point is, it's like, you know, if somebody shares this, has this perception of reality, and they're absolutely convinced of it, you know, if I didn't have that sense of self, that sense of integrity, that sense of that grounding, it would be very difficult to deal with people who often attribute things to me that are completely, completely contrary to my reality. And have a rational conversation about that. Say, well, I realize that you might think that I astral project in your room, but I really wasn't aware that I did that. So, you know what? I'll talk to my soul and I'll tell it to stay home. Boom. Done. Not offended, not kind of grossed out a little bit, but certainly didn't show it, you know. And I'm able to do that because of, you know, I applying these principles in my respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So when I get accused of things that are pretty delusional, they don't affect me. I don't have that sense of, how dare you? I have compassion. And I certainly don't want to belittle people for having a disease that causes them to have a disruption in their perception. Because, geez, isn't that a little familiar? You know.
That ties into the next line at the bottom of the page.
That's where I was going.
Most of us sense that a real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. This goes back, for me at least, into the wives. okay? And this tolerance of other people's viewpoints and attitudes. I walk into an AA meeting, and I hear this, you know, disco variety drunk sharing about how they put the plug in the jug and they make lots of meetings and they talk with their network and blah, 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 blah. And there's no real book solution in what they're saying. I'm not getting pissed off at them anymore. Okay. I'm accepting them for what they got and who they are and what they're doing. But what I am doing at the same time is I'm looking around the room and I'm seeing who's not getting it. Who's the ones that are, ooh, no, that's not right. You know, I'm looking for the type fours in the room that aren't vibing on this so that I can talk to them later. You know, I'm accepting this person for who they are. I'm not suddenly raising my hand saying you're full of shit, you're wrong, because all I'm doing then is I'm separating myself from them and I'm ruining a future opportunity to be of help to that person. You know, because in a year, that person's going to come around if I'm tolerant.
Well, see, I just share my experience and keep it in the eye, and everything I say contradicts what they do, but I just don't, like, I just don't even look at you. I'm like, type two, that disco variety, I'll share over here, and I'm saying the exact opposite of whatever it is that you said, very nicely with a big smile. But because I used to come out swinging. I'm going to tell you where you're wrong, and now I just share my experience, and I will outright contradict you with a big-ass smile on my face and pretend that I'm not sharing at you, but at least I'm not going to fight with you in a freaking meeting about it.
No, but when on the same level, though. No, because I do the same thing. I do the same thing. But what I do is I found that I refer to the wives. Yeah. I refer to the hopeless variety. I refer to alcoholics who are like me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And what that does is that allows the other alcoholic to be an alcoholic in that room and not feel like I judge them.
Yeah, because we used to walk in and say, get out.
Yeah, you know,
like, you're not
like a
me,
real alcoholic
out.
If that's your experience.
Leave my AA. Stop doing that.
And I found that's not effective. You know, I'm not looking to have us and them. I want AA. You know? I want unity in AA. And if that means that I gotta suck it up and work a little harder and practice tolerance for people who just have no friggin' clue what this solution is, until they're ready to ask for it, then that's what I do. Yeah. Because I found, and I told this story yesterday, there's this guy in my area with 27 years who has no idea what the steps are. He does his own four-step.
He's going to spontaneously combust one day.
He reads his own inventory to himself, and, you know, he doesn't need, you know. But he called me up a few months ago and said, Adam, I got a guy that I used to work with that I can't seem to help. Can you help him? If I was an intolerant, you know, rabid big book thumper like I used to be, that would have never happened. That would have never happened, you know. But because I try to accept him for what he is.
He allows him.
Yeah. I try to accept that. He doesn't feel the animosity. You know, he doesn't feel, you know, he feels like he can call me and say, hey, here's a hopeless one like you.
Yeah. We try to work and well, play well with others, even if I don't agree with them, and I think they probably should go knit the hell out of my fellowship. That's just, you know, that being said, I try to tolerate the fact that they're in there and at least make use of them when I can. I know that sounds mean, but, I mean, think about it. How many times you sat in a meeting and you're thinking, okay, you know, two-thirds of you guys can just go home and watch football and get the hell out of here because you really don't need this the way I do. You know, today, instead of actually saying that to them, because I used to. I was very popular. But you know, think about it. It's like, I'm like, you know, I'm 5'4", you know, I look like a freaking 15-year-old wearing ripped jeans and a spiked belt, and I come up and I'm like, get the fuck out of my AA! You're not a real alcoholic! They're like, isn't she cute? I got away with it a lot. But you know, the thing is I want to work and play well with those people, and I want to be able to, you know, give them help them so that they can carry a message with depth and weight. Because the fact is that as Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to have we have to be unified, and we have to carry a message. And we're letting people fall through the cracks because we're too divided. You know, a house divided, you know, will not stand. So, you know, ultimately, I need to fit myself to be a maximum service to God and others, and if that means tolerating people who I think should go home, that's what I got to do. I'm not. I told you he's the nice one. Real quick before we wrap this up, we're just going to quickly hit on it says on page 24. It says the fact is that for most alcoholics, for I'll, reasons you.
I'll read it.
What? Okay.
You're
go
dyslexic.
Ahead. Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink.
And of course it's italicized, because Bill is cheap, so italicized costs more, so if you italicize it, it means it's really important. You know, and this is the idea, is like that concept that I choose not to drink, that I have a choice in drink today, I don't.
Think the drink through.
Yes.
I got a great story. I thought the drink through. They told me you got to think the drink through. So, you know, I wanted to get loaded. You know, so I got to think this drink through. Well, I'm going to go to the bar and get some tequila. Yeah, okay. What's going to happen next? Then I'm going to go to the liquor store and I'm going to get a couple bottles of Mad Dog. Okay, cool. And then I'm going to grab a cardboard box and I'm going to go to Tompkins Square. I'm going to hang out, drop some acid. Everything will be cool for a little while. I'll hitchhike up to Woodstock. This is back in 94, and I'll see the concert. And then I'll find a bus or a hippie van or something like that, make my way out west, and I'll live on the streets of Berkeley for a couple years, and then maybe if I need to, I'll make a meeting. Sounded like a good idea, and that's what I tried to do.
Yeah, pretty much. We didn't make it.
I thought it through to the end, and it sounded like a good idea. This is the mind of an alcoholic.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is that it might work one or two times where, like, you think it through, and you think, oh, my God, oh, terrible things are going to happen to me, but the fact is that there's going to be that time I can't. So we cannot rely on our minds, and that's ultimately this message, is that I cannot rely on my mind or my thinking when it comes to myself and my alcoholism. I need to have a defense that comes from something greater, because the mind is a human power. And it says the certain consequences that come won't come into my mind, and if they occur, they're hazy and readily supplanted by the old threadbare idea that I can handle myself like other people. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. You know, so I might think that drink through and say, oh, this is going to suck. But ultimately, whatever pain that's going on within me that's making the drink look like a good idea, that's going to win out. Because here's the thing, is that sucky, emotional, horrible, sucking, terrible pain, being ruled by fear and hating myself and everyone, or possibly getting in trouble living in hell. I'll take the possibly getting in trouble, because my current circumstances suck so greatly. Whatever you might possibly happen if I do this, forget it. That's a possibility. Whereas my reality sucks so bad that any possibility is worth getting out of where I'm at right now in that emotional pain. You know, so that's why we can't think the drink through, because there's going to come a point where the potential consequences don't matter. They don't matter, you know. And so then, it goes through the different types of thinking, you know. And again, you know, each one of us is different, and Bill really goes through it in great detail. And, you know, our thing is not necessarily to go into great detail the type of thought process for the alcoholic or the thought process that precedes a relapse. Because, well, one, it's laborious. And two, that's really what sponsorship is for, you know, is to sit down and talk about those intricacies of your alcoholism. But we want to be able to have that common language. No, we discussed what craving meant. We went through great detail what that means. We talked about what it means to be the four different types of alcoholics. We talked about what it means to not be able to think the drink through or have a mind that cannot see or perceive our alcoholism and our drinking appropriately with clarity, right? And then, you know, we have that, and 2 seconds I'll hit this and we'll finish this up. And it says that the type of thought process that precedes the relapse. And it says that, you know, often we talk about the parallel thinking. I'm trying to find Jim. There we go. And it says that on page 37, And he's talking about Jim, and Jim had a resentment, right? He was a car salesman for the concern he once owned. He went to work. He had words with the boss. He obviously didn't make amends. Went out on a sales mission, and thought it was a good idea to put whiskey in milk. I think you know, people are hookers a lot better, but whatever. Whiskey and milk. Anyway, my point is that it says you may think this is an extreme case. To us, it's not so far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characterized in every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim on the consequences, but there was always that curious mental phenomenon that paralleled with our sound reasoning. There inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. The next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity, how it could have happened. So, again, you know, it might be, you know, nobody loves me, nobody likes me, I'm going to go eat worms, so let me go, you know, smoke some crack or drink some Mad Dog. Or it might be, like, everything's wonderful, and see, like, I made such a big deal about that alcoholism thing, you know? A couple of arrests and rehabs, really? That was just a phase. I can drink successfully. You know, when you think to yourself, when you think I can drink successfully, you're an alcoholic. Normal people don't think I can drink successfully. That's not a term that they really have. Think about that for a minute. Because, you know, so really, you know, ultimately the idea is that, you know, whatever my thought process is, whether it's justification because people suck, or a rationalization that, oh, I was making a really big deal about that, you know, that, you know, arrest and DUI and, you know, divorce and my family hating me. That was, they were just so unreasonable. Whatever that might be, I'll have that idea. I'll say, you know, that's kind of weird. Like, why am I thinking like that? Like, you know, just don't drink. You know, it's not a very good idea. But that reasoning, that sane idea, almost never wins. Ultimately, that rationalization, justification, or just plain old I don't give a shit wins out. You know, and that's that parallel thinking. And I want you to think, and you know, where else do I have parallel thinking? Mm-hmm. You ever do that, like with shopping? You ever like, you know, Bloomies with those shoes? They're beautiful shoes, and you know you can't afford them, but you really, 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 really have to have them. And you sit there and you're wrestling with yourself, and you're going, well, you know, I'll just pay my light bill late because I really need those shoes. Ever do that?
I need a new hard drive.
It's called parallel thinking. All right, so why don't we take a 10-minute break and come back? Cool. I need a smoke.
You ran over. You
Shut
ran
up.
Over.
Be quiet. We got to pack this, though, right?
He's got it.
Oh, you got it?
I got it.
We're pretty close to being all back, so...
I just wanted to touch on something.
Choke.
Yeah, as I choke on my dip here. Yeah. Now something we were talking about in the break, and I wanted to throw this out there. You know, my truth doesn't have to be yours. It's been done.
Did I do it right?
My truth doesn't have to be yours, and everybody needs to find their own spot. You know, we were talking about the tolerance and listening to the whiny, you know, type twos and all that shit, and you know, and there's two different approaches. We both do the same kind of deal in our personal lives, but we have a different way to address this. You know, so my truth doesn't have to be your truth, and your truth doesn't have to necessarily always line up with mine. And I was telling a story. I was talking to Mickey about the disease of alcoholism, and his perception.
Mickey B.
Yeah, okay. His perception of the disease of alcoholism is drastically different than mine. You know, and we argued, I mean, tooth and nail across, you know, for like 2.5 hours about this, and I walked away from this conversation feeling like crap, there's something wrong. And I called up a friend of mine the next day, and I told him what was going on, and said, something's wrong. He goes, he asked me, is that your truth? You know, is Mickey's truth your truth? And I said, no, it's not. And he goes, well then, who cares? You know your own truth. Know what's real for you. Know where you fit, you know, and what your job is.
That old saying, don't let anybody read your big book for you.
Yeah, you don't have to. You don't have to buy into everything that I'm saying up here, or anything that she, everything she's saying up here. You know, yeah. Well, you got to listen to her, but but the idea is find your truth. Really, you know. So
once more. Page 43, real quick, just to make sure you didn't get it the first 47,000 times. The alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. And that's a huge consideration. Do I believe that? You know, and ultimately, you know, in my personal life, do I live as if that is true? I mean, there are times when, honestly, I'm living as if that's not true, because I'm just constantly rearranging the seats of the Titanic, and I'm trying to fix up the outside while the inside is crumbling, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, it'll all be okay. I'll make it okay. You know, and then I wonder why I have a whole bunch of untreated alcoholism going on and everybody thinks I'm a dick. And it comes down to that idea that I'm trying to provide a defense against my alcoholism, against the first drink. From a human power, and you know, and that's that belief. Do I really believe that human power has failed me? That is the crux of being a hopeless alcoholic: is that human power has failed me and has not been able to allow me to stay away from alcohol. I can put it down, but I can't have any lasting abstinence from alcohol when I'm using a human power. And there's this phenomenal website. I'm gonna pimp them out. I know you don't like that. I have a friend, his name is Barefoot Bill, and he has this website just called Just Love Audio. And it's got these resources, and Bill's a geek. Like he's an uber big book geek. I mean, like, he's a crazy uber. He, like, went to, like, Brown University and researched Bill Wilson in their library and stuff. I mean, he's, like, an uber geek. And he's got these he's got resources there. And it's, like, and it's resources on the 12 steps, 12 concepts, and 12 traditions. And he's got every handout imaginable on this website. Any possible application, idea, exercise that you could possibly think of
dittos
galore. But it's a phenomenal website, and it's got a lot of information on it. Just Love Audio. And it's been incredibly useful. I pimp it out all the time because I'm lazy. And if my sponsees can go there and print it out for themselves and I don't have to print it for them, I'm all happy about that. I send them the link to the PDF, and I'm like, print this out and go do this. Yeah. Yes, Just Love Audio. And
the one thing, though, I wanted to throw out there real quick is about what she just said. The alcoholic at certain times, okay, and don't let that certain times think you got power, you know, cause you to think you have power. Because there were certain times that I was able to manage. And certain times I was able to be okay to a degree. But ultimately, if I can't do it, if I can't guarantee it 100% of the time, and I don't know what that 1% looks like, I have no power. You know, that's the real thing. You know, and that's how I get a lot of these young people too. Is like, you know, I can think through the drink 9 out of 10 times, but I don't know what that one time looks like. I don't know when that one time is going to happen. Do I really have power?
You ever have a beater piece of shit car? You know, and you get, you know, you're
still
late for
one.
Work. You're late for work, man. Like, you know what? You dawdled a little too much. Maybe you had a fat day and you had to put on like 7 pairs of pants before you found that one that didn't give you the muffin top. And now you're late. You're in the car and you're thinking to yourself, God, I hope this car starts, right? God, I hope it starts. And, you know, and it doesn't. And you're like, fuck! Right? It's the exact same thing. Think about that. It's like, you know, it starts every other day except for the day that you're late and you don't have time to fiddle with it, and you go to start it and shit, doesn't start, man. Mm-hmm. Now you're really late for work. Same thing. Can't rely on it. It's an unreliable vehicle. I'm unreliable when it comes to being able to erect or use human power to be able to treat my alcoholism, and therefore I can't rely on it. And one of the things what I was saying was that if you, in Bill's story, he talks about all the different things that he used to try to control or treat his alcoholism through human power. He talks about ego. He talks about how, you know, he was alcohol's master. He talks about how he can laugh at the gin mills, right? He was cocksure, which I love that statement. I was cocksure. I can laugh at the gin mills. I had what it takes, right? And then he drank again.
Threat of suicide.
Suicide. He talks about...
moving to country.
Yeah, country and back. Geographical cures. He talks about using pills. Sedatives.
Taking drugs. Did you ever take drugs to control your alcoholism?
Fuck yeah.
You know, I smoked a lot of pot so I wouldn't drink. You know, a pot kept me away from booze for a really long time.
Yeah.
You know, it worked for a period of time. But it didn't work 100%
Fear.
Of the time.
Fear, scared straight, you know, when people talk, it's like when Bill said, fear sobered me for a bit.
Remember your last drunk?
Yeah.
I was talking about this the other day. My last drunk was, my clean date was just the other day. I don't remember my last drunk. I don't remember the day. You know what
I'm
I mean?
I'm sure we smoked dust.
We did smoke dust. I've got three photographs in my mind of that day. I didn't remember my last drunk. Does that mean I'm going to get drunk? You know, according to the fellowship, it does. But you know, that again, human power.
Again, if you're an alcoholic like me, you don't remember most of your drinks. I'm just saying.
For the last 5 years, you know.
And Bill also talks about knowing the first drink. He said, I knew that the first drink would get me drunk. Right? Mm. Swearing on the Bible, making oaths. He did all of those things throughout his story. The first 8 pages riddled with ways that Bill used human power to control his alcoholism, and all of them failed him. So when I'm reading that chapter and I think about all those things that Bill used to control his alcoholism, right? If none of those things worked for me and none of those things worked for Bill, then I'm a hopeless alcoholic just like Bill, because human power failed me just like Bill. You know, so and that's, you know, when we're talking about the hopeless alcoholic, that's what we're talking about. The hopeless alcoholic in which human power fails. And so it says that I can't rely on my human power. My human power is a hoopty that's going to make me late for work. And I can get a shitty car.
Oh.
You know, but I can't guarantee that it's going to start.
But that was a Yugo.
No, it's called the hoopty. You know, and so I, you know, obviously, I, you know, if you have a hoopty and you can trade up, you would, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
So this is an opportunity for us to trade up and to gain access to a power that we can rely on. You know, to get access to a power that we can rely on that will allow us to have a defense against the first drink. And it has to be a power greater than myself.
Page 44. In the middle of the first paragraph, it says, if, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic.
See, Bill, like, spent, like, I don't know, 50-something pages describing the first step, and then he, like, summed it up, like, so perfectly and succinctly in one line. Control and enjoy and control. Boom, done. See you later.
If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. You know, one quick thing real quick. I don't find the term disease in here. I really don't. I know we use it a lot. But I see illness. I see malady. You know, it just kind of triggered something in me, because I don't necessarily find the word disease.
It is? Picture, yeah.
Okay. I don't remember where, but I like to use the term illness myself, because I like to be a little true to this book when I'm speaking about it. And if you notice, I use that term a little more often.
Yeah. You know, and the idea is that this is a real big consideration. Do I believe that? Do I believe only a spiritual experience will conquer this? I mean, there's two things to this. I mean, you know, if I have this illness and I've identified this illness and I've identified what the three aspects of alcoholism and I realize that this is my lot, this is who I am. Okay, my only hope is to have a spiritual experience. But by saying that I'm suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer, it also implies that this illness can be conquered.
Mm.
So in this very consideration is what I like to call a result. I don't like promises. I was a freaking liar. Like, you know, and we hear in AA all the time, the 12 promises. I'm like, well, you know, dude, One, we got like about a kabillion promises in Alcoholics Anonymous.
240 or
something like that. You know, and we talk about, you know, 12 promises. Like, really, if the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous stopped at the 9-step, man, you're missing out. Dude, you're so missing out. Because, like, I don't know, the 11-step promises and the 12-step promises are way cooler. No offense. You know, so one. And the 10-step promises, for that matter. No, think about that. It's like we got three more sets of promises that come after the 9-step, but I'm going to settle for the 9-step promises? Dude, the good is the enemy of the best, you know, with that one. So, I don't like to use the word promises. I like to use the word results, because I believe in cause and effect. I mean, I'm scientifically minded, and so I like to think about things in terms of cause and effect. You know, if I do this, I get that. So, when we're talking about saying that if I have this spiritual experience, my alcoholism will be conquered. That's a cause and effect. Do this, you get that. And so I like to think about it in terms of results. So when we're talking about what we're going to get, because now Bill's really going to talk about what we're going to start getting out of this. He explained to us how screwed we are, and now he's going to start saying, okay, now we have a solution, and we kind of touched on it, and there's a solution. He says, you know, self-searching, leveling our pride, confessions and shortcomings, blah, 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 blah. You know, he kind of hinted at what that solution's going to look like. Now he's going to go into greater detail, but he also knows alcoholics were pains in the ass, and we won't do anything unless we're sure we're going to get something out of it. So what he does is, as he says, well, you're going to have to do this, he starts to tell us what we're going to get from it. And as we're looking at what I like to call the results of the work, I want to look at it and say, well, are these manifesting in my life? Is this currently going on? Is this my current experience with this? Because if there isn't, maybe I can go back for a retooling and I can start getting more benefits from this. And so it's also a diagnostic tool when I'm looking at the results. And, you know, and I can say, well, if I'm not getting that, if I'm not happy, joyous, and free, if I'm not, you know, brotherly, harmonious, whatever, sunshine flowing out of my behind, whatever that promise might be. If that result isn't manifesting in my life, well, maybe there's something I can do to bring that about. Let me take a look at that. What am I missing? And that's really cool, because sometimes it's something really simple as maybe, you know, like adding a little bit of time in my meditation, or maybe there's like a slight unmanageability in my life I need to address, maybe like a resentment, what I call annoyances but are really resentments in disguise at work or at home, or it's just something very simple that I can just tweak, and all of a sudden, boom, I start getting those benefits again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a promise as well as a consideration. Do I believe a spiritual experience will conquer my alcoholism? So I can have it be conquered, but I have to do something to do it. There are no free lunches in Alcoholics Anonymous. No free lunches. You must pay the piper for everything you get, but what you get will be in abundance.
Bottom of the page.
Well, there's two things: to be doomed to an alcoholic death and live in it. To one who feels he's an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience may seem impossible, mm-hmm. but to continue as he is means disaster. If he's an alcoholic, the hopeless variety, so we don't make that stuff up. We're not that smart. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives. It says alternatives, not choices. Choice implies power. Alternatives, you know, we have viable options. Die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis. The only viable option I really have is to live on the spiritual basis. And Bill's very clear about not using the word choice in terms of this, because he doesn't want to give us the delusion that we have power. Words are powerful. I don't like to use the word choice. In fact, I try to remove the word choice from my vocabulary when it comes to alcoholism in general, because that implies that I have something to do with why I didn't drink today.
It took me a good 5 years to start using the word choice again, you know, selectively in my life, in different areas. I choose to go to the grocery store, you know, things like that. I completely removed it. I know me. You know, and I know how to manipulate my own mind. You know, and I know that if I use this word choice in my life for anything, I'm going to start using it in areas that I don't have choice. You know, because it's just habit. You know, so I removed it from my vocabulary for a good 5 years at least. I don't remember when I started using choice again. You know, but because I had to. You know, it's a way to dope fiend my own brain. Yeah. You know.
So we highly suggest that in terms of your alcoholism and your internal monologue, you know, we all have that internal monologue. If you start thinking, well, I'm going to choose the words of steps, so why don't you say, I opt for the steps.
Make a decision.
Make a decision. You know, because again, that place is you know, we have locus of, you ever hear a thing called the locus of control? Mm-hmm. And we have internal and external, right? The idea is like whenever anything happens, like you say, you know, something's going on in your life, right? We either look within and we blame ourselves and say, oh, I'm a piece of shit, this is why things suck, or we blame other people outside of us, right? And say, everybody else sucks, that's why everything sucks. And the idea, especially with our alcoholism, and when it comes to in terms of addressing my alcoholism, I like to have an external locus of control, not putting it on you, but on God, saying, God is my source of recovery. God is my source of power. That power does not come from within me. Even though God dwells within me, and therefore it sort of does, and that's sort of the oxymoron of the whole thing, I try to think about it in terms of that power, the recovery, that access, that source of defense does not come from me, but comes from God. So I try to think about it of having an external locus of control regarding my defense against the first drink, my defense against my ism, the untreated alcoholism.
Interesting spin on what she was just saying about the external God and all that, you know.
Internal, external God.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. You know, because some of us have, in the Western kind of religions and theologies and whatever, it's real easy to see God out there, and we can access that power out there. But some of us start to seek towards more Eastern philosophies, and I know I did. And what helped me was to kind of visualize, and I'm a very visual person in my spiritual life, and I'm the apple on the apple tree of God, you know. So God is within me, but I'm not the roots,
yeah.
You know. I'm not the trunk. I'm not the branches. I'm not the tree. I'm just a piece of that puzzle, and I still need to access outside.
Yeah. Matrix.
The Matrix. Yes. Fight Club, The Matrix.
Yeah,
is
Matrix, you know. There is no spoon, man. Ultimately, however you need to perceive it in order to make it work for you is awesome, but ultimately there is no spoon, because whether it's an internal or external locus of control as far as God, it's somewhat irrelevant. You know, it's really about what makes it easier for you to understand your place in terms of your alcoholism. But there is no spoon.
The socket is everywhere.
The socket is everywhere. The spoon is everywhere. The matrix is everywhere. And you're a part of it, whether you know you're in it or not.
You know? We're getting
weird.
Whatever
you want to tell yourself about it to make it work out for you, you bop to you drop. But ultimately, you know, there is no spoon.
So we go in there. I got it. I love it. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. I knew what it was, what it meant to be good. You know, I was raised with beliefs and morals and, you know, shit, I lived on a commune. You know, I know what it means to share and be unselfish.
You lived in a teepee.
I lived in a teepee. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us. So breaking my sandwich in half and giving it to the guy next to me, you know, or sharing that pocket full of acid with people, you know, and you know, did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed us utterly.
See, Bill's really smart. Because first he, like, he kind of focuses us and he says, well, let's talk about the physical. Because the physical is, like, pretty... If you're an alcoholic, you know, and you put alcohol in your body, you know that feeling of loss of control, right? You can't control it. That's pretty simple, and that's a pretty, like... concrete example. And then he starts moving us to the mind, and he talks about how, you know, the rationalizations, the justifications, the lack of power, not being able to think or drink through, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay, that's more ethereal a little bit. And now he's like, oh, by the way, that same powerlessness you have with being able to think to drink through, guess what? You can't even think yourself into being a nice person. Because even when you think you're being unselfish, you're probably being selfish. Even when you think you're being honest, you're probably being dishonest. And you could try really hard to be philosophically comforted and to be all moral and upright and upstanding, but inside you know you're a fucking liar. So, your human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. And that's a real consideration, honestly. Like, I don't know. I didn't wake up in the morning and be like, by the way, I want to be a sneak thief and a douchebag. This is my plan for the day. I'm telling a story about how I ended up at somebody's house, and I came home with some man's shoes. I don't know who they were. I woke up, and I have this memory of stumbling home with like these shoes hanging from my fingers. And I woke up the next day, and they're like size 12s sitting next to my bed, and not really sure how they got there, whose they were. But some dude shoes. I mean, I could have peed in them. I don't know why I took them, but I stole their shoes. I don't know whose they are. I don't really know what happened to them afterwards either. I probably like hid the evidence. So I mean, like, I didn't wake up in the morning and be like, I want to like get drunk and end up at some random dude's house and steal his shoes in the middle of the night and come home with them. That wasn't my plan for the day, but it seemed to be how things worked out. Because I wasn't able to. I would get up in the morning. I'd be like, I'm going to be good. I'm only going to drink a little bit. And I'm not going to stab anybody. I'm not going to steal anything. I'm going to try not to set any fires. I'm really, really going to try not to get arrested today. You know, and I would start with this plan. I mean, I kept my expectations really low, guys. I told you that. You know, it wasn't like I was going to be like, you know, a young Republican. I was just trying not to end up in jail or kill anybody. Like, that was my plan for the day. If I could do that, it was a very successful day. Or myself, for that matter. Like, yeah, you know. And so, you know, like, that was my plan for the day, and somehow I couldn't even manage to, like, not do those things, you know? I would end up, like, you know, robbing people and, you know, setting things on fire, and I'd think, how the hell did I do that? Like, I didn't start my day thinking that, but the fact was is that my human resources, as marshaled by the will, failed utterly. I mean, I can keep my expectations as low as I wanted, but I ultimately couldn't live up to them, because that's the lack of power, that's that lack of center. When I talked about that lack of center, that lack of identity or sense of self, that integrity that, you know, within us, that, you know, if you've been recovered, you know what that is. And if you haven't been recovered, it's like that absolute feeling of absence. And you know, and like I said, it's like you'll be talking and you'll just think, if I shut up now, this conversation will be over, this argument will be over, and you can't shut the fuck up. That's what I'm talking about.
There's also the other side of that too. When like I was saying before, it's like I was raised with these ideas, you know, these communal ideas and this selflessness idea, and I was really intent on practicing this way of life, this kind of, you know, hippie free kind of whatever, you know, share this, share that attitude, but the bottom line is the delusion was there. You know, the delusion was built into me. And yeah, I'm sharing with somebody else, but there's an underlying motive that I was totally unaware of at the time.
Got it.
You know, there was an underlying motive that, you know, yeah, if I give away some of my acid, you know, I'm going to have a bunch of friends. You know, or somebody's going to smoke with me later, you know, or somebody's going to buy me a beer later. I wasn't thinking about this. I think I'm being unselfish. I think that I'm doing the right thing. But that underlying motive, until I started to actually look at myself, didn't become apparent. It wasn't there.
See, you're even giving, like, what about, like, you know, just getting laid? You know,
well, that,
like, it's like, oh, they'll like me, and I'm like, no, no, no. Take it to a basic level like that. If I give you acid, and I get laid.
Well, that's a given, but you know, so even
let's go to the more primal nature of these things.
even when you think you're doing the right thing, and you're in this delusion. You know, we're still powerless. We're not able to live up to the expectation of selflessness. You know, I wanted to be selfless. I knew that that was the right thing to do. But I didn't know how, because I was selfish at my core. You know, I was incapable of being selfless.
You ever, like, walk into a meeting and, like, you're doing all this, like, 12-step work, and you're like the big book guru, like, the big book ninja, right? And you're rocking, and you have all these sponsees, and they're all, like, following behind you like little ducks, and you got your book, and you're fucking cool, right? And then you realize what a D-bag you really are, because you're just doing this because you want to feel important in AA in a program full of nobodies. You want to be the coolest kid on the AA block and have, like, the best speaker talk, and I know this person, and I had coffee with this person, and this person person's my sponsor, this person's my grand sponsor, and I had this pedigree, and I wrote a 47 area inventory, and I made the most amends ever. Ever had one of those conversations at the pissing contest with the amends? Human power.
King of the land of the misfit toys.
Exactly. But, you know, so sometimes we can actually take something so beautiful as the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and use them. Our ego will use anything in order to kill us, including the 12 steps.
And so, lack of power. That was our dilemma. Oh, it's not the booze.
No. So our real problem is that, you know, literally, we lack the power to be able to be any, be or manifest the very things that we want to manifest. You know, you get this vision in your head, and you cannot make that a reality.
We had to find a power by which we could live, not necessarily not drink, but live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how do we find this power? That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem.
Now, it doesn't say drinking problem, does it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh. I love that. It says my problem. Well, of course, my problem is me, so it'll solve me and all will be good, right?
Mm.
But, you know, and again, so like, and again, I work with a lot of people. I mean, by virtue of my profession, I end up like being very tolerant with people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have dual diagnoses. So I end up working with people with outside issues, a lot of them. And I'll say to them, and I'll be talking to them, and they'll be telling me about whatever crazy thing that they're doing, and they're like, well, that's my PTSD. And that's my depression. And that's my obsessive-compulsive disorder. I'm like, I don't know, I'm an alcoholic, and I do all those stupid things, too. Is it possible that, you know, your mental illness, your label that you're using is limiting the power of God? Is it possible that, you know, that this program can be applied to those problems as well in conjunction of whatever you're doing within the medical community to address these issues? It says, it'll solve my problem. It doesn't say my alcohol problem. And by the way, alcoholism looks like a whole lot of mental illness. I'm just saying, you ever read the DSM-4 and go, well, that's me. Because alcoholism, at its core, looks like a lot of diagnoses. And I'm not saying people are not truly mentally ill, but what I'm saying is that it's hard to tell the difference sometimes between a true organic mental illness and alcoholism. So I tell people, stop trying to figure it out. Work the program as if it'll work or fix everything, and let's see what happens. It might. For me, it took care of 75% of the craziness, and therapy took care of the rest. Awesome. In conjunction. We don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, we don't limit the power of God or this program either. So I act as if it'll address all my problems, and if it doesn't, then I go somewhere else. But I certainly don't limit it and say, oh, it'll only fix my relationship with alcohol. This book doesn't tell me that. It tells me that it'll solve all my problems. And if that means removing my prejudice in order to seek help outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, great. But it says it'll solve all my problems. It says it'll solve my problem. So just something to think about. The next time I say, gee, I'm in, you know, double dip recession, and, you know, and my financial problems really suck, and how am I going to take care of all these bills, and how am I going to have this, and how am I going to wear my designer jeans? Well, this book says it'll solve all my problems. Maybe I just have to stop shopping at Bloomie's and start shopping at Walmart and reduce my expectations. It's amazing how this program and humility can take care of a lot of these problems. You know, so when the next time I say God won't work or God won't fix that, God won't address my, you know, all the external problems in my life, and I have to remember that I cured the greatest problem I ever had, which was my alcoholism. So why the hell won't it take care of my financial or my marriage or my relationship with my children or my work issues? I mean, my alcoholism was way more insurmountable than any of those stupid petty things. It'll solve my problems if I'm willing to allow that to occur.
Sounds good. Page 47?
Yep.
Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. Now, I was a rabid anti-Catholic when I came in. And, I was under the impression that I was going to hell from the time I was in the third grade on.
You were.
You know, it's like I got caught in the bushes by the nun with the dirty magazine at 9 years old, and I was done. It was over, you know. And my whole life I felt that way. I didn't not believe in God. I just believe I was fucked. You know, that God had wanted nothing to do with me. And this book and this process gave me this line. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms. You know, what do I think God is? You know, don't let that prejudice me against having an experience. You know, don't let it prejudice me, because I walked in thinking God was mean. You know, I really did. And I had to set aside that prejudice and that idea of what I thought God was so that I could access God.
The other thing, too, is you're supposed to be asking yourselves what these spiritual terms mean to you. Mm-hmm. Bill names 101 spiritual terms. If you go from his story, Bill's story, starts talking about all these spiritual terms, and then we read Reagnostics, and we keep reading through this book. I mean, Bill's throwing shit at a wall hoping something will stick. And the idea is we're supposed to take these terms, these concepts of God, and we're supposed to say, what does that mean to me? Do I like that? I mean, and it's actually a really neat spiritual exercise to go through this book. And it's something I did, because I am a geek. I'm an uber geek. I took a clean book and a highlighter, and I went through it, and I highlighted all the spiritual terms in the book. And I brought them into meditation a couple at a time. I said, well, what do these mean to me? And every day I would just take, you know, a new concept, and I would just sit with it. What does Tsar of the Universe mean to me? Is that my experience? Is that the kind of God I want to have? Yes, no, maybe so. Next one. And it was a really neat thing, because it kind of really got me to look at, because sometimes, you know, we think about it, it's like, you know, a lot of times I operate and I don't always stop to think about what I really believe about God. I just kind of go. I got a God, I need a God, I'm going to die if I don't have a God, I got to do this and go. You know, and sometimes it's very helpful to take a step back and say, well, do I like my God? You know, do I like my concept? Like, if I'm, you know, I can remember I had a woman I worked with, she was gay. And she was also a Jehovah's Witness. Didn't go well together. She kept drinking. Every time she had an illicit relationship with a woman, she kept drinking because she believed that she was going to go to hell. And I was like, dude, here's the thing. It's like, you can believe that, you know, you can change yourself and make yourself straight. I was like, I know a lot of gay people that really didn't work. I'm sorry. Like, you know, didn't work for them. So you could do one of two things. You can either get a new God that maybe likes gay people, maybe a little bit. or you got to make yourself straight, which is easier. Has making yourself straight working? Has it been working for you thus far? Mm-hmm. No. It's like, well, maybe you have to like accept that maybe there is a God that doesn't think gay people suck. Maybe. And when she was able to work with that and get to that, you know, and say maybe my concept of God, you know, that her concept of God hated her, according to her. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be a God by which I can live, and it has to be a power greater than myself, but it has to be a God by which I live. If my God doesn't like me, I'm fucked, man. So sometimes I need to take a look at and really say, what do I really think about God? What is my perception? And so doing that exercise of highlighting all the spiritual terms in the book and then sitting with them is a really good exercise for taking a look at how I really think about God. No.